All right, the last matter on our oral calendar this morning is the case of Robert Louis Freeman III versus the state of Minnesota. And counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your oral argument, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments this morning.
Good morning. John Orenstein of Green Espel for the appellant Freeman. May it please the court. This court is well familiar with the exoneration compensation statute, but it was amended.
Some more than others.
It was amended in 2019, and this case is about words that were added in that amendment. The words are any evidence of factual innocence. Those words were added to define the term grounds consistent with innocence when one is referring to the grounds of reversal that trigger the rights under the statute. And the question here is what those new words mean. Before applying it to the facts in my case, I'd like to talk about what I think they mean by giving a few examples from cases that, from cases gone by that the legislature was aware of. So Back versus State, the defendant was convicted of homicide based on culpable negligence, and that conviction was reversed for lack of a duty on which to base negligence, a clear case of legal innocence as opposed to factual innocence. That's excluded from the scope of the statute. Buell, there is the hypothetical example of a person convicted of drug possession whose conviction is reversed because of an improper search. Clearly excluded from the scope of the statute. Why? Because in that hypothetical, there is no evidence of factual innocence. Quite the contrary, there is evidence of guilt, and it gets excluded if there's a new trial. Then there are the actual facts of Buell itself, an improperly admitted prior conviction, and the conviction is reversed. Again, no evidence of factual innocence involved in those grounds. So we have legal innocence excluded, technical violations excluded, and now we come to Mr. Freeman's case.
Well, and your case is somewhere in the middle. Those are two, I think, clear cases of how this court should rule, but on that issue. But in your case, and I think I think the operative phrase is, and there is any evidence of factual innocence.
Yes.
And that's what we're discussing here today.
Yes.
And what facts, what evidence is there in this record of factual innocence?
The sum and substance of the evidence that the lawyer in the counsel, ineffective assistance of counsel opinion, that the lawyer didn't collect, didn't produce, is evidence that the accuser was inventing the allegations.
Well, except, because we always in district court had people, in fact, both sides, we had people that weren't the most credible of witnesses, and that especially in criminal cases. Yet, a jury always had to decide whether whatever they were testifying to these people at the time, whether they were telling the truth. And this often happened in gang-related cases where you might have a witness that would otherwise be incredible, but because they're testifying on behalf of the state, the jury was faced with the decision of deciding whether to believe this person or not believe it. And I think we instruct the jury. You can only, you're the final arbiter of the credibility of these witnesses, and even though that people may have lied in the past, they may be telling the truth now. How is any of this testimony of this witness, how can you say that's proof or evidence of innocence? It's just another bit of evidence that she may have had problems with veracity in the past.
Well,
how is that consistent with innocence or even evidence of factual innocence?
Well, in a case...
Necessarily.
Okay. It's a little bit case-specific, I think. In this case, it was, as the court on the ineffective assistance case said, the case turned primarily on the testimony of this witness, of the accuser. And just about the only way that you could tend to convince the jury that you're innocent, not that that's really your job, it's reasonable doubt, but let's say you want to create reasonable doubt by having a jury think that you're innocent. One of the principal ways you do that is to show that the accuser is not telling the truth. How do you do that? Well, there's cross-examination. But in this case, you have four witnesses who would have testified to a pattern and practice of the accuser reacting this way when confronted with authority or assertions of authority that she objected to. And that's just about all that the defendant would have had here, and it would have made it, I'm sorry, there is a reasonable probability that it would have made a difference. Now, there might be many cases where the lawyer doesn't do everything he can to impeach the witness. And very likely in those cases, it's not going to be ineffective assistance of counsel. Why? Because there's other evidence. It's not reasonably likely that it would have had an impact on the jury. But here we know it would have.
But does it, I mean, in this case...
Well, we know it might have.
Does it necessarily mean that this is evidence of factual innocence? Because the jury could hear these four witnesses and say, yes, this is a troubled child. She's been trouble in the past. Yes, she's lied about things in the past, but we believe her now. I mean, so it doesn't necessarily equate to evidence of factual innocence, does it? I mean, it's obviously some good impeachment, but does it equate to evidence of factual innocence?
I think what we're talking about is the difference between evidence of something and establishment of something. So take the Utah statute. It says that if somebody wants to have these rights, they have to show evidence that demonstrates their innocence. Our statute doesn't say that. Our statute says evidence of it. A jury can always disregard
evidence. Any evidence.
Yes. And it might not carry the day with the jury, and Judge Cashman said that too. But that doesn't mean it's not evidence of something. It's still evidence that tends to show that the story is fabricated. And if the story is fabricated, that's evidence.
Let me ask you this,
that the person is innocent.
What if what was not found by trial counsel was that the victim had five convictions for giving a false statement to the police? And that wasn't disclosed or whatever. You know, he didn't find it, even though you can find it. Is that evidence of factual innocence that would require remuneration under the statute? Those convictions.
Let me answer that in two steps.
Because that's even better than what you've got, right? I mean, you've got... not just some people saying she's engaged in a pattern of dishonesty. That would be she's been convicted of a pattern of dishonesty five times. So is that evidence of actual fact? Is that any evidence of factual innocence?
If it becomes grounds for a decision to reverse the conviction, yes, it is.
But that's different. That's getting you a new trial. Here we're not talking about that. We're just saying, is that evidence of factual innocence requiring remuneration under the statute, or I guess requiring you to at least get a hearing on whether you get remuneration under the statute?
Well, it, Your Honor, what you just said about there being grounds for a new trial, we're looking at the grounds for either reversing the conviction or granting a new trial, those grounds have to be grounds consistent with innocence.
Right, but I mean,
we're talking about defining
in,
that.
In the past, when people bring post-conviction relief motions for a new trial, you know, it's got to be new evidence. It's not just, well, you know, credibility, and now we've got other witnesses who can say she's lying. Mm-hmm. It's really, what's the new evidence? You know, the newly discovered evidence, the new DNA evidence, the new alibi witness, the recantation, you know, that's the stuff that we usually are looking to grant a new trial. So, or for example, you know, let's say, you know, on a motion for a new trial, or no, excuse me, a motion for a withdrawal of a plea of guilty based on actual innocence, you know, it's the actual innocence is, you know, the police have come back and they say, you know what, I think we got the wrong guy. You know, so that's innocence. I don't think in those cases we've granted plea withdrawals based on, oh, and by the way, the witness was not credible related to things other than the sexual assault. So that's what I'm struggling with. You know, and it seems to me, if, you know, by your hesitation, I mean, it seems to me, if you're saying this is evidence, any evidence of factual innocence, then five prior convictions for making a false statement would be even more evidence of factual innocence, would it not?
Well, it would, but what I'm having, what I want to get across, I think, is that there still has to be this threshold that what you're talking about becomes the basis of a reversal or the basis of granting a new trial, and none of those standards change. If
well, then I think you lose if they don't. I mean, if we're incorporating those standards to any evidence of factual innocence, then I think that's a problem. I mean, I think what you're arguing is say, you know what, any means any. Evidence means evidence, and you certainly got those two. The what we're struggling with, I think, is, well, innocence. And in the past, I'm not so sure we've said evidence of impeachment. Impeachment evidence is evidence of innocence. So that's my point, and I think I'll stop talking now because I've done most of the talking.
Well, I think in this context...
Well, it can't be in this context. It's got to be, you know, at some point we're going to have to say what innocence is because the statute doesn't say it. So, I mean, are we going to go all in? And you know what? Any is any. Evidence is evidence.
I think you can say any evidence of factual innocence including means what it says because...
Which means including impeachment.
Because this is a threshold inquiry. Because, as you pointed out, Your Honor, all this does is give Mr. Freeman the right to go ahead and try to prove his innocence by a preponderance of the evidence in an evidentiary hearing. And it ought to be enough to get him there that his conviction was vacated. It was vacated on the basis of evidence that would have tended to show that he's right, that he didn't commit the act. And that's why this case should go forward.
So is there... So the basis for, you read the statute to mean that the basis for the decision has to be related to whatever any evidence is. So, for example, if this evidence had come in at trial, let's say, but for some reason on jury instructions it was reversed. You know what I mean? It's an unrelated reversal. Mm-hmm. But there is any evidence. You're saying, no, they need to be linked together. What the evidence is needs to be the basis for it. So it's generally talking about exclusion. Let's say the trial court, we decided on appeal, erroneously excluded the impeachment evidence of five convictions for this witness or erroneously excluded another witness that would have impeached something or other. I'm trying to see, it seems like, you know, is there a line between impeachment evidence and evidence of factual innocence? And where would that be?
Well,
that's a hard thing to locate, I think.
Part of what you said, Your Honor, I think you put your finger on the one thing that worried me about the statute when I looked at it. But you're entitled to read the statute as a whole. And if they're talking about the definition of the grounds for the reversal, mm-hmm. then these this evidence must have had something to do with the grounds for a reversal. Mm-hmm. And are there is there somewhere in the world of impeachment where you draw the line when you're talking about extrinsic evidence that should have come in under, under an established rule like 608, and it goes to the core of the case, then I don't think you're at the fringes of what impeachment gets in and what doesn't. If any gets in, if any becomes the grounds consistent with innocence, this ought to be the case that does it.
Could I just ask you, because one thing I think it was brought up by the respondent here is that when there was this new definition on grounds consistent with innocence, one of the things that came up during the legislative hearings is they wanted to codify our understanding under Buell and back, I assume. And if that's so, I mean, hasn't the legislature, and looking at that legislative history, isn't that the line they're drawing, is that, you know, unless there's specific, I guess I just want to know where you think the line should be drawn, but and why. But in that, if there's evidence of factual innocence, that has to be some specific evidence, such as we've discovered a witness that saw me. I mean, the guy said, or he has some kind of proof that I wasn't there. It was another guy. I mean, and here we don't have that. We just have an ineffective assistance of counsel. We don't have a jury verdict, nothing. So is this case more like Buell in that this is a technicality? I mean, it's ineffective assistance of counsel. He gets a new trial. He gets a do-over. But this is not the kind of case that permits him to bring a claim like this.
I have two quick responses. Yeah. One, if I were a legislator reading the Buell case, I would focus on the parts that say the evidence we're talking about there has nothing to do with guilt or innocence. This does have something to do with guilt or innocence. So it is different from Buell. And the second part is, as a legislator, when I used the words any evidence of factual innocence, it appears that I deliberately didn't exclude impeachment evidence. Again, the way the Utah statute did. I didn't exclude any particular kind of evidence as long as it has to do with factual innocence. That's a decision the legislature made, and it needs to be respected. Thank you.
And could I just confirm, too, I know we're over, but I just want to make sure that we're talking about step one of the statute, correct? This
Absolutely.
Is just determining who can bring the petition.
This is whether he has a right to the evidentiary hearing to make the showing he needs to make.
And according to your understanding of how this law is to be interpreted, if he meets step one, the gatekeeping step, he can still go on to a hearing where it would be obviously not a criminal standard, but I assume it'd be a preponderance of the evidence as to whether he did or did not do this act. Am I correct?
That's true, and where the state has a lot of latitude as to what it gets to put in.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Ole Tweeden. I represent Respondent State of Minnesota. I'd like to piggyback on a couple questions that Your Honors have asked, starting with the last question, because I don't want to forget to get back.
Thank you. I was hoping you'd start there.
It definitely is a threshold issue. And when we talked about floodgates, and you see in the brief, the state's concentrated on some of the legislative history and avoiding a floodgates issue. And my concern about the floodgates issue is not just that people will get compensated in a large amount, and that's what the legislature is concerned with. In this new amendment, the concern is also that we are here today, not just here at the threshold issue, but then we will be here again later at a full-blown evidentiary hearing. Mr. Ornstein is absolutely correct that I do have a lot of latitude of what I can put in terms of evidence. There already is an entire trial here. But the best evidence in this case, and when it gets to character for impeachment evidence, is that victim, the alleged victim's testimony. And that testimony was heard by a jury of 12 people. It won't be heard again. The judge won't listen to it unless she comes back and testifies. And as I put in the brief, and it's true, and we would argue, that's part of the reason we didn't redo this trial. And it puts that person as potentially a subpoenaed witness by the defendant because, or I'm sorry, the appellant, because part of their what they want in that hearing is to prove that she's a liar. And part of the reason they prove it is to attack her either for character for impeachment, but also some claims that this, that, and the other thing was said was untrue back when she was 11 to 13. That, to me, is the floodgates issue. We have these long, drawn-out hearings, essentially a second retrial. In some cases, in a case like this where the state believes, in fact, that appellant was, in fact, guilty, still believes it, hasn't changed, having that second trial, regardless of whether you convict them or they're found not guilty at an actual jury trial in a criminal courtroom, you then potentially have a second or third trial built in. And that is a floodgates issue. It's maybe not a financial issue for the legislature, but certainly a retrying of cases that have already been tried.
And which is what this statute contemplates in order to compensate people who've been incarcerated without a conviction then. And so where is the line? What's the line between impeachment evidence that is extremely important in a case because the case really relied on one person, the victim's testimony about what happened, and something else? Where is that line?
I think the line is at impeachment evidence, Your Honor, and thank you for the question. I think by defining it as character evidence that can be impeached for truthfulness, whether that comes in the form of the character evidence alleged to be in the case here, whether that comes in the form of the similarly situated 609 evidence that Judge Connolly has mentioned, in any form, relates only to the credibility of the witness. That was for the jury to determine. And in terms of equity, I totally understand, obviously, innocent people who have been incarcerated.
But they couldn't determine that because they didn't get the whole picture of your victim, because because the lawyer didn't do his job.
Yep.
I mean, I understand what I'm saying, but what's your response to any is any, evidence is evidence, and you know the legislature didn't specifically rule out, you know, didn't have an exception for impeachment. Why isn't this evidence of innocence?
I think it's not any evidence of factual innocence. The way I read the statute and ask the court to read it is...
What is evidence of factual innocence, then?
An alibi witness, a determination that the individual was not there at the time that the crime occurred, potentially a recantation that led to the...
But isn't evidence, assuming there's evidence that the victim is a congenital liar and she lies about things like this in order to get away from controlling foster parents or controlling father, why isn't that evidence of factual innocence? Because if she's lying about these things and making up things, isn't that a factual evidence of innocence?
I think it's for the same reason that the rules determine this type of evidence is handled differently in terms of reputation and opinion, and that's why it's normally brought in only through reputation and opinion evidence, because it relates to something else that didn't happen on this time or on this date or wasn't talked about this specific incident. It relates to her character or reputation. To me, it's more similar to Spriegel and prior bad acts evidence, which, of course, is not admissible against the accused because of the criminal consequences to them without establishing by the state a long list of things that are of hurdles to overcome. To me, it's more like that. It's something else that we normally keep out. We allow it in solely for these purposes. What you've touched on, Judge Hooten, is... we allow it in, and we put it on a long list in the jury instructions. And on those long lists are demeanor, frankness, sincerity, relationship to the parties, lack of interest, et cetera, and impeachment. And then separately for impeachment, you get to describe and you get to determine as a jury or a fact finder in court trials whether or not that person's prior convictions or their prior character evidence related to their prior character for truthfulness weighs into your credibility determination.
Well. Could I ask you this now? Because I'm again, you agree, we're just talking about the gatekeeping.
Yes.
Provision one, yes. Now. But one of the definitions is ordered a new trial on grounds consistent with innocence, and the prosecutor dismissed all felony charges against the petitioner arising from the same behavioral incident. And I won't read the rest because that's what's applicable here. I mean, if I'm looking at this, I mean, this is the definition, or these are the two circumstances of exoneration. Here we have a prosecutor who didn't proceed here because based upon the, I mean, and I think it's reasonable to think that maybe the reason the prosecutor didn't proceed here is because he had this information about this lying propensity of this victim and the circumstances under which she lied, and that the prosecutor wouldn't be able to proceed because that high burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. And I mean, isn't that significant here in interpreting whether there's any evidence of factual innocence and reading those two together, that obviously there was enough here that the prosecutor didn't want to proceed with the second trial? And I know you said it's because of the, you know, you don't want to have the victim on the stand again, but I mean, I think it's obviously going to be a harder case.
Oh, no doubt. And but as I outlined in the brief, there's a lot of reasons this becomes a harder case. And neither Mr. Arnstein, myself, his client, the alleged victim here, wanted this to go the way it went. Let's have one clean and fair trial, and whatever happens, happens. In terms of whether or not why the prosecutor would have dismissed a case, that is admissible as evidence at the evidentiary hearing. It's something we get to argue. And we certainly would argue and say why we did that. It is not because we don't think it happened. It's not because we necessarily don't think we would prevail at trial. Every retrial, whether it's a mistrial or anything else where your witnesses have already testified, becomes harder to prove. In these cases specifically, I mean, she was a child when this was alleged to have happened. She was 19 when it finally got tried after six resets. She would be about 24 right now, and by the time we would get it tried again, those are all things to consider. She's already gone through this, had closure. It was unclosed when we found out that his attorney hadn't done his job as well as he could have, and we have to make those reasoned determinations. That, to me, is simply a mechanism by which either we lose that trial, we dismiss it, and it was done on the grounds consistency of innocence. I don't think that adds to the idea that any evidence that led to it must be related to factual innocence. I think that's really juxtaposing that between the situation where we don't agree. We don't agree that this was a wrongful conviction.
Yeah, but in that, this is the same statute.
Yep.
I mean, and you have to read the statutes in conjunction with each other. Doesn't that seem to suggest, though, that because the prosecutor may choose not to proceed, that this may be evidence, in this case, of factual innocence because the prosecutor can't meet that high burden of proof?
Well, it would, and it goes to the nature of criminal sexual conduct cases and probably all the cases where credibility will be central. I mean, there's many considerations in charging that never gets in front of a court as to what can happen. There's many times I believe someone happened and tell them, we can't charge a case, we can't meet our high burden. I don't believe that that's the case, though, because you don't want to encourage prosecutors to simply go ahead and try the case again, just because then that creates the differentiation between, well, if you tried the case, you must actually believe it, and if you didn't, you don't. Go ahead.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, let's just assume someone from heaven comes down and tells me this guy was completely innocent.
Yep.
All right. And we assume he's completely innocent, and I think we're under the law we're to assume that. Under this, under your interpretation, how could he ever bring a claim if the prosecutor just dismisses the case? I mean, under this statute.
Under the statute, if we dismiss the case, after it's been overturned, he's in the same boat as if we tried it. I mean, it goes back to on grounds consistent with innocence, whether there's any evidence of factual innocence that led to the overturning of the conviction. If I dismiss the case prior to that happening, he hasn't sat the prison time, and thus he doesn't, there's nothing to be compensated for. Am I answering the question, Your Honor?
I'm just trying to figure out how to interpret this statute.
What if there was something like a DNA result or something at trial, and then but there was a whole host of evidence that was wrongly excluded and reversed for the exclusion that seriously undermined the reliability of that test result? You know, there were tainted lab procedures, there was fraud, who knows, there was bribery of the, you know, real stuff that really undermined it. Is that just impeachment? Would that person not have then, that would not be a situation of evidence of factual innocence? Instead, that person then couldn't cross the threshold, then meet the threshold here?
No, I believe that would meet the threshold. I think that gets to the any evidence.
What's the difference if it's impeachment evidence of the DNA result?
Because the DNA result relates directly to this case and thus related to his guilt, his or her guilt in this case, and thus if it's not true and not accurate, it's a fact in the case of what happened that was turned out to not be true here.
And how is that different exactly from someone's statement of what happened and then that's undermined by excluded impeachment evidence as opposed to here's the DNA result that implicates you, but that's undermined by impeachment evidence?
I think the difference is I think you can still get statements in if, for example, the witness was said to have said something, whatever that is, about the case, and then later said or it turned out that that statement was not true or was coerced, that specific case. Or they had a prior inconsistent statement related to it where you could impeach them related to the statement about this case, about what happened here, as opposed to generally his or her character for truthfulness or other character type attacks that are normally collateral to the issue at hand. Here, the DNA is obviously not collateral. It's a part of the case. It must be relevant to the facts of the case. The collateral pieces to impeachment are solely related to whether or not character impeachment are related to whether or not this person is being truthful.
So it might be that in a case, if instead the evidence that was at issue here was instead she told three other people this never happened.
Yes.
Okay. You're leaving open the possibility that that might actually be that excluded evidence that she told others that it didn't happen, even though she might have told Corner House it did or something in a given case.
So yes,
that might be evidence of factual innocence, and it's not just purely impeachment. That becomes evidence of factual innocence.
I would go so far as to say it would be.
It
absolutely would be.
Yeah.
Because then it's not just she's lied about other things. She's lied about the central issue of the case, which is I was raped. And the evidence is she told three other people, no, I wasn't. That clearly is evidence of innocence.
Absolutely.
Okay. So we need to think not just beyond impeachment, but also like what it is, what the testimony is about relative to the facts of the case.
Correct. And so when I say impeachment, I shouldn't be, but I've been using shorthand for character for truthfulness. Impeachment related to collateral issues, not related to the facts in this case. And I agree with Mr. Orenstein, and Your Honor, when you talk about what happens in a case like this, this is almost always going to be a credibility case, and partly that's the uphill battle for the state, given the high burden of proof, is usually child sexual assaults are alleged to have happened when no one else is around. Certainly that's where the literature says how they happen. And so you have one witness and you have one other. Same thing with domestic assault. Same thing with other intimate partner violence. You have those cases. And when we get back to floodgates issue and when you look at this law as a whole and what the legislature is trying to do, there's nothing in there like this type of case where they said, you know what, you should have done better finding evidence that could have attacked the credibility of this person related to other items, and the credibility is really important in this case, as it always will be, and it will always be in any case, and eyewitnesses' credibility wouldn't be important as well. I see I'm running out of time, but I just want you to concentrate and ask you to concentrate on what that evidence really means. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good
Well, I think what we just heard from the state is that it wants to draw a bright line where impeachment can never be evidence of factual innocence. And that's just not in the statute. Other statutes draw that line.
Well, actually, I think that he said that if in fact, with regard to this specific incident, mm-hmm. she had told others that it did not occur and that she just made it up, that would be, and that he didn't do it, that would be evidence of factual innocence.
Well,
so I think there was a distinction made there.
If he's drawing a distinction between different kinds of impeachment evidence, I understood that he was saying that would be a different thing. Then it's where is the, I guess the line we're talking about is one where the witness spoke directly about the case and one where the witness didn't. But
well, and where she's actually saying he didn't do it. I mean,
that's
clear evidence, I think, of factual innocence. But let me ask you this, because, and we'll get to the floodgates argument that was made. I mean, anytime there's ineffective assistance of counsel and you find information that should have been presented, I mean, depending on how we interpret this, wouldn't this, any evidence that would have helped the case be evidence of factual innocence if we determine it as you've asked us to do, so that anyone could bring a claim?
Well, I think the set of cases where an ineffective assistance of counsel claim is successful and results in a reversal or vacating conviction, it's a small universe. I mean, I know it happens, but those claims are common but not commonly successful.
Well, you know, following up on Judge Hooten's point, let's try this scenario. His conviction is reversed for based on ineffective assistance of counsel. For whatever reason, the state does not recharge him. And the evidence, the sole evidence, or the any evidence of factual innocence is, your client on the stand in the first trial said, I didn't do it. Is that any evidence of factual innocence? Any evidence of factual innocence is, the person on trial in the first trial said, under oath, I didn't do it. And now they didn't, you know, cases, you know, tossed for ineffective assistance of counsel. They decide for whatever reason not to charge him. He now brings a claim under the statute, and he's saying, any evidence of factual innocence is, at that trial under oath, I said, I didn't do it. Is that any evidence of factual innocence?
No, because
why not?
Because I believe the evidence of factual innocence has to be a ground of the reversal. And in the hypothetical you're posing,
I don't know about that.
Well,
where does it say that?
Because it comes within a definition of grounds consistent with innocence, namely grounds of the reversal.
Well, the grounds of consistent with innocence is I didn't do it.
But that's not a ground of the reversal. It's not a ground of the decision. The decision has to be made on grounds, and the rest follows.
And the grounds were ineffective assistance of counsel.
For what, though? For
who cares?
Oh, but I think it does matter. The reason I think we have a claim here is that the ineffective assistance of counsel was for failure to produce this evidence. It can't be that in the hypothetical where the defendant testified that the ineffective assistance of
say the ineffective assistance of counsel was a failure to demand a speedy trial, and there was a clear violation of a speedy trial demand. The trial went on anyway, and he gets on the stand and says, I didn't do it. So under that scenario, why isn't that evidence of factual innocence?
Because it's not one of the grounds for reversal. The ground for reversal is, and this is a good example of why ineffective assistance counsel claims won't open the floodgates. There are lots of situations like that where the lawyer made a procedural or legal mistake, but it doesn't have to do with factual innocence the way this one does.
What about if a conviction is reversed for insufficient evidence? there was insufficient evidence to support the conviction. And in the trial, presumably, there was evidence, let's just assume, to support innocence, whether it's the defendant was on the stand and said, I didn't do it, or there was some witness who said he was with me or whatever. What does one do in that situation? Is that, again, different because the reversal on insufficient grounds doesn't relate to the particular evidence of innocence at issue? That would not meet the threshold, even if you could pick out pieces of the trial that supported him.
That's what I believe.
Okay.
I think there's no other way to read all of that subdivision one in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, this is just to decide who gets to bring the claim.
That's right. Can he go forward?
And so even in the situation that Judge Smith brought up with the insufficiency of the evidence, I assume there under Part 2 there would still be a trial as to whether, with a lesser burden of proof, as to whether or not he did it. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding, and I just want to say one thing. I think this discussion has brought out that Subdivision 1, at least as I read it, still performs its gatekeeping function, doesn't open floodgates, and keeps a lot of claims from going to the next step, but not this one.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for your excellent arguments here today. And we will take the matter under advisement and get an opinion out within the statutory period of time. Thank you.